Welcome to Everyone Loves Guitar, where we sit down and talk with interesting professional guitar players, uncover their stories, and discover what makes them tick. If you love guitar, music, and the backstory of people's lives, stick around. You're in the right place. This episode of Everyone Loves Guitar is brought to you by Taylor Guitars and their new Grand Pacific Round Shoulder Dreadnought. Powered by Taylor's breakthrough V-Class bracing system, the Grand Pacific gives you a warm, seasoned sound with clear low-end power and notes that are stronger, longer sustaining, and more in tune with each other all the way up the fretboard. Make sure you check it out online at taylorguitars.com, then go out and play one today. That's the new Grand Pacific at TaylorGuitars.com. Did you know if your instrument or any of your gear is damaged, broken, or stolen outside your homeowner's insurance policy will not cover any of it? That's right. Homeowner's insurance only pays if something happens inside your home. But Music Pro Insurance insures all your music gear, no matter where it is, anywhere in the world, even when you check it in as baggage on an airline. Here, let me give you some examples. Let's say you're in a car accident and your equipment is damaged, you're covered. Your kid pours apple juice into your amplifier, covered. Someone spills beer all over your pedal board at a gig somewhere across the world, boom, you're covered. Any kind of theft or accidental damage is covered, even water damage from hurricanes and breakage from earthquakes. But here's what makes Music Pro really different. They're not going to argue with you over the value of your instrument or make you run around looking for receipts when it comes time to paying your claim. They know exactly why your vintage instrument is worth 10 times more than a new one. Plus, all claims are typically paid and fully settled in 24 to 48 hours. So if your equipment is not insured properly, go to musicproinsurance.com, hit standard, then enter your information and get a free gear protection estimate. Don't be that player who ignores this, and then next month when something happens, you're wondering why you didn't take 10 minutes to do this properly. Make sure you go to musicproinsurance.com, enter your information, and get a free gear protection estimate. If something happens, you will be thanking me. Trust me on this. musicproinsurance.com. The Be Fulfilled Journal helps you be more honest with yourself and with others, and be more open to handling things you've avoided dealing with for years. It's a 12-week online and journal program that helps you identify and eliminate things you do that are causing you stress and live in more gratitude and joy. It was actually developed by a long-term friend of mine who got sober in 2008, and he's put together a great deal just for my listeners. You get the 300-page hardcover journal and access to the 12-week video program online, plus free shipping, plus membership in a private Facebook support group with others going through the program, plus a 5-day mini course showing you how to let go of stuff that's draining your energy, plus a 30-day 100% money-back guarantee. To start your journey and get all the bonuses, go to befulfilledjournal.com/ELG. That's befulfilledjournal.com/ELG. For information about advertising on Everyone Loves Guitar, including information on geographically targeted ads, go to everyonelovesguitar.com/advertise. That's everyonelovesguitar.com/advertise. Hey, everybody. This is Craig Garber. Welcome to Everyone Loves Guitar. And my guest today, we're going to show some love to the rhythm section. Not only is he a cool guy, he's got like the coolest name ever. He could have done anything with this name. I mean, seriously, man, this is like the perfect entertainment. John Button. I mean, you could have been like anything from the most famous musician or actor, or like, you know, the guy who hosts the game show, or who's like the best Santa Claus in that's like the best name in the world, I swear.
Well, say, I thank my my parents.
They did good, man. For that. They did great.
They worked it out.
John was actually from Alaska, and he was inspired by his four older musician siblings to start playing at a young age. He started piano at age 4, and that laid the groundwork to move to string bass and bass guitar at 7. By 14, he was playing in local jazz and blues bands, symphonies, and pit orchestras. In high school, he was honored with making the All-National Orchestra, the All-National Jazz Band, and he won a scholarship to attend Berklee College of Music's summer program for high school students. He then accepted a scholarship to study at University of North Texas in Denton, where like all the cool guys in the Midwest go. And he played in their Grammy nominated top jazz band. I've interviewed a ton of great musicians from there, man. He then moved to LA, and since then he's toured with many major artists, including The Who, Sheryl Crow, Robin Ford, and Shakira. He also played on recording sessions for albums from many artists, as well as major movies and television shows, including the Emmy-winning score of Batman and Beyond animated series. He's currently out on tour with Roger Daltrey. And before we get going, I just want to give a shout out to our man, Jason Orme, for hooking us up.
Nice. I feel like my life just flashed before me.
This is, you know what? You're so, like, I know you've probably played, you like, I always, it's always like this. The guys, like you just said, I've played with some other sessions basically, but you didn't say who. I'm sure they're like major artists, guys who do like a lot of interesting stuff. Give me like a fucking paragraph. Guys who've done like, you know, maybe not a lot of interesting stuff, I get a page and a half of you know, like I remember when my mom saw me performing at 7, and I'm like, yeah, that's real sweet, but I don't know how many people are interested in that. Anyway, dude, thanks so much for coming on the show. I appreciate
it. My pleasure. Happy to be here.
Yeah, man, this is good. I've interviewed a bunch of musicians from Alaska.
Strange. There's nothing to do there. Sorry to interrupt. There's nothing to do there, but you know, it's dark all winter. What are you going to do? Sit in your basement and practice, I guess.
Do you know David Meyer, guitar player? He's out with Felder.
No, I don't know Felder. Him.
Yeah, another guy. You know Rick Holmstrom? He still lives in Alaska.
Yes. I know of him. Yeah. I think we've met.
Yeah, he's a West Coast. He tours all over with Mavis Staples, but I noticed most of his stuff is West Coast. And then Chris Latham is original. Do you know him from Bisto Blanco?
I know of him. Yeah. Yes.
He's an Alaska guy, man.
Yep.
Never met There's people from Alaska. Now I met tons, man. I need to meet people in like Italy and shit like that. So I have.
Stick with Alaskans. Alaskans are cool.
Alaskans are very cool. It's probably not a destination I'm going to hit. That's the only thing, man.
Dude, you should go. It's awesome.
Really?
It's amazing.
I don't know. I'm going to go to Hawaii. I got to get there again. So I don't know. Maybe I can do a Hawaii-Alaska trip.
There you go.
But let me ask you this. So all the people I've interviewed from Alaska you guys all have exactly like we just said, yeah, come to Alaska. It's great. There's like very deep ties to not just to the state, but to everything like it gives you nature wise. I noticed like everybody really is grateful and like has enjoyed nature. I was curious how you feel about that and what you miss most when you left for Texas.
Yeah. I mean, it is the nature component there is so strong. It's so kind of in your face there. It's so beautiful. And there's so much just pristine, untouched wilderness that just if you haven't spent time there, I would imagine it's probably hard to even imagine that there is just this expanse of untouched wilderness that just goes on forever. There's like hardly anybody out there. It's just miles and miles of miles and miles, you know?
It's beautiful, man.
And that is what I did miss when I went to Texas. It was quite a shock. you know, I mean, picture in Alaska where I was growing up, my parents' house, you know, you look out across a beautiful valley with hills on the other side, and then behind those are snow-capped big mountain peaks, and like it just looks like a, you know, a painting, Bob Ross painting.
Yeah, Bob Ross.
Out my living room. No, seriously. Yeah,
that's so cool.
And then, so I go to Texas, and when it becomes winter in Texas, there aren't really any evergreen trees.
Yeah.
So pretty much everything's brown. There's no snow to cover the brown. It's just flat. I mean, no offense to people that love Texas, but for me coming from Alaska, I'm sitting there and it's just flat. Brown, there's just nothing, and it was quite a shock, and I definitely missed that real beauty of Alaska, you know, all the mountains and beautiful green trees, and you know, in the winter everything turns white like a little winter wonderland. It's pretty amazing.
Very cool, man. Yeah, I noticed that with everybody. I wrote down those three words: pristine, untouched wilderness. Now, flip the switch minute. I'm from the Bronx. Top three words somebody from the Bronx never fucking said in their life about their environment. Pristine, untouched wilderness. That was great, man. That was awesome, John. Man, all your brothers and sisters played music. Were your folks musicians or like part-time musicians or?
Yeah, my parents both played music. That's cool. Neither professionally, but my dad played woodwinds, and he used to, you know, make little instruments when he was a kid out of whatever he could find around, you know.
That's cool.
And he was really into like big bands and swing music and stuff. And then my mom plays piano and sings, and she sang in the local choir, and yeah.
Very
cool. I think they thought it was enriching, you know, for us to learn how to play music. So all of us, you know, started piano real early. I think I probably started younger than any of the other kids. I think, you know, I mean, I think maybe I just turned five when I started piano lessons.
That's really young. Yeah.
Pretty young. God bless my teacher. I think her name was Teresa.
Everybody who had a good teacher remembers that teacher. It's really funny. I mean, like anybody who had an influential teacher, no matter how far back, you know, I've interviewed guys that are in their 70s and they remember their first teacher that was really helpful to them.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, I got to look her up. My piano teacher, Sue, she's still around in Alaska. I got to reconnect.
Yeah, man. Now's the time.
Yeah.
I was going to ask, what did any of your siblings become professional musicians?
My oldest brother, who was a drummer, he went to Berkeley Boston. And he made a go of it for a couple years, and you know, life kind of got in the way. He had a kid young and was sort of like, I need to take care of my kid. I can't be scrounging around, you know, eating top ramen. So,
yeah, that's tough when you have a kid.
You know, I mean, he, maybe things being different, maybe if he didn't have a kid, he'd sure. still be doing it. My sister got a scholarship to Indiana University.
That's another great school.
On violin.
Wow. Dude, this is wild.
Yeah, so she was real serious. But I think she had the realization that to even have a shot at competing as a classical violinist, you have to practice like 9 hours a day, like crazy. And yeah. She was sort of like, man, is that for me? She was a natural, you know, I think she just kind of could do it. I don't think she was interested in putting in that kind of time commitment, I think the impression I got. So she, moved on to other things, but all my siblings, you know, they all were great, you know, did like whatever the All Northwest Orchestra or this and that.
That's really cool.
Another brother played trumpet. Another brother played woodwinds. And they were all very good.
It's five kids, man. God bless your parents. That's like,
right.
That's,
oh my goodness.
Yeah. That's pretty,
I can't even imagine one kid is, well, you have two, right?
No, I have three.
You have three. Oh my goodness.
But they're all grown, but that's why I have no hair. I will tell you straight up, man, these fucking kids, man. Because it's not like three times as much work. It's like
it's exponential.
Yeah, it's exponential. It's like to the second, to the third, you know, and each one, it's just, and then by the third one, you're just like, man, fuck it, whatever happens, because it's just like, you know, this is too much, you know, you just, whatever, you know, it's, you know, you see that cartoon, there's some meme or something, you know, your first child, like something drops on the floor, you're like, oh my God, you know, and right. The second child, you know, you pick it up and wash it. And the third child, you're like, you know, you don't even look, you know, just eat off the floor, whatever. It's because you're exhausted, man. You just can't, you know, it's tough to manage.
I mean, I think partially who my parents were or are, and the time, you know, I think there was a certain laissez-faire, just like whatever.
You have to with five kids.
Yeah, I guess. I mean, and I think we were pretty good kids. Like, we had our heads screwed on straight for the most part.
Yeah, that's great.
You know, they kind of just let us do whatever.
That's cool.
I don't think when you're in much trouble.
Yeah, but in Alaska, can you? I think you really have to work to get in trouble. I mean, right?
Depends on what kind of trouble you're talking about. I mean, I can remember.
Here goes. The dirt comes out in the wash. John Button.
No, a buddy of mine, we must have been, I don't know, 8 years old or something. He came over to my house for a play date or whatever. We were hanging out. And he was like, oh, let's walk back to my house. And I don't know why, for some reason. So it was probably like two or 3 miles.
It's a lot house. When you're eight.
In the winter. It's winter. There's like 3 feet of snow. It's probably maybe it's zero if you're holy lucky. Crap. We're like, cool, put on my snowsuit. Let's go walk to you. We walked to his house. I don't know. We were doing a bunch of dumb stuff. And apparently his mom like lost it and like freaked out on my mom because like, what are you doing, Letterkin? But we, you know, I grew up in the like, you know, do whatever you want. So I was like, yeah, let's walk to your house. That's cool.
But, yeah, it's different.
I mean,
you have
the reality
siblings.
Is you're walking. I mean, I don't know if there was maybe one or two houses in those 3 miles. Maybe. I mean, we're just walking through the like tundra. Like,
no, that's so pretty scary.
We could have, you know, we could have gotten in a lot of trouble theoretically.
Yeah. Wow. Oh. Well, now she wouldn't have been upset at your mom. She would have just sued her.
What, right?
You could have had a lawyer.
Yeah. What do you call it?
Child, whatever, DCF or whatever.
Yeah, seriously, these days, if you let your 8-year old walk for 3 miles, you get arrested.
Yeah, absolutely, man. It's a different world, bro.
Sorry, I'm not down with that.
Did you go to school at I know it's called, I think, North Texas State now, but it was University of North Texas when you went, probably.
I think it's the other way
around. The other way around?
Maybe. Yeah. Anyway, yes, I went to school there.
Did you go to school, or do you have any alumni there that like who's sort of well known now that you played with?
Yeah, I probably the biggest name of note would be Keith Carlock.
Oh yeah.
Sure. Of Steely Dan fame at this point, probably. He also played with Sting and James Taylor and all kinds of people. So he and I got there at the same time, and actually he and I met so. In the little prologue there, you talked about, I got this McDonald's All-American band thing.
To Berkeley.
He was in that as well.
Okay, cool.
So we met in high school, and I totally remember, like, just something. He was playing, like, marching band stuff, like snare and all that stuff. But I was like, this dude, like, I could tell. I was like, this dude's got something special. And so we met at that point and we kept in touch and we sort of were like, I remember, I think we were actually writing letters to each other or maybe calling on the phone.
Hold on a second.
Internet.
For anybody under 25, a letter is something that, it's like a sheet of paper and you just put some thoughts down on it and then you put it in this thing called the mail. US Postal. Sorry.
Right. It was before the internet.
Yeah. That's cool though. I did that with a couple of people. That was like a nostalgic memory of like, yeah, I know.
But so we were like, hey, you know, what are you doing for college? Like, you know, we were both of us were sort of like maybe Berkeley, maybe North Texas. I was sort of thinking maybe something in California. I didn't know, but we ended up both going to North Texas. We're like, hey, dude, let's room together.
Oh, that's great.
So we were roommates we lived in the dorm together the first year and then we got apartment together the next like 2 years. It was cool. We played
really
together
nice.
All the time. He obviously he's still a monster, but I mean he was exceptional. Really exceptional. Anyway, so
that's cool.
One of the many.
Did you guys like as you were both, you know, kind of growing your career, did you have each other to talk to like, hey, this is going on, what do you think, or what's going on with you?
Maybe a little bit. I don't think we didn't talk too much career stuff, but we would definitely like, you know, I moved to LA, he moved to New York. We definitely still keep in touch. And, you know, when our tours with cross paths, which they do, I can remember hanging out with him in like Madrid, Spain. Like,
oh, that's cool, man.
You know, hanging out. He's, you know, one of the many amazing musicians that came out of there during the time I was there. And he's probably the best known, but they're, are many guys I went to school with that are doing all kinds of great things.
Yeah, that's really cool. The whole, you know, Snarky Puppy, all those guys, well, not all of them, but the lion's share of those guys came from there.
Absolutely. There are also quite a few guys in Nashville, a lot of drummers in Nashville playing with all kinds of big big people, and a couple of bass players I know too that are doing big country tours out of Nashville.
I think she's a little younger than you, Lindsay. What's her last name? Really good jazz guitar player, and she's in Nashville. Really nice woman.
I've heard of her.
Brain fart. Yeah, really nice. And she told me that the reason I thought of her is because when she first came, was Keith ever in Nashville for a minute? Maybe
he lives there now.
Okay, then so yeah. That's what happened. He invited her to come over and play, and she was so like, oh my god. And and she said on the interview, I remember her saying she was really intimidated, but you know, they had that North Texas State thing, and he was just incredibly ingratiating to her and, made her feel awesome. Really welcome. And she's a monster player. So, I mean,
right. That's nice to hear.
Yeah. Yeah. So what was your first, you get out of college, what was your first major gig, John?
Oh my goodness. That's debatable, depending on your definition of major
gig. Your definition doesn't matter mine. No, your definition totally doesn't matter.
I do remember kind of one sort of little stepping stone. When I got out of school, I stayed in Dallas for maybe about a year. And right before I moved to LA, I started playing with a smooth jazz artist named Joe McBride. And that was my first quote unquote tour. Oh my God, which is hilarious. So, I get the gig. It's the first tour is like a short tour in the US, and Joe is a piano player and singer. He's a blind guy what's the politically correct way to say that? Is that right? Blind? I don't know.
Blind?
visually impaired?
Doesn't matter. Whatever you say, somebody's going to get offended.
Good point.
So it doesn't matter. There's no bad intent, so that's it.
All right, the dude can't see.
Right.
So he's amazing too, amazing musician, blah, blah, blah. So I get called to do the tour. I'm like, I don't know, 22, just out of college. It's pretty cool, like, wow, a real gig. I talk to the manager, hey, how much is the money? It's like $3 a week or something. And
you're like, yes.
Right, yeah, exactly. And how are we getting around? Bus. Dude, a bus tour. Awesome. Great. Sounds great. So then, whatever, a couple weeks go by, time for the tour. Here's your tickets. Tickets. Tickets for what? The bus.
You're going to like go down to the Greyhound?
Yes.
Oh my God. God.
So in the manager's defense, he was like, I don't want to lay it on the musicians to draw. Like if we do a van tour, they all have to drive. Joe can't drive.
Sure. Sure.
You know, cause he's
not seeing.
Yeah. He can't see so good.
Yeah.
So the manager was sort of like, well, this is the best option is to put you on a Greyhound bus. Yeah. So dude.
Yeah. But there's no part of your whole thing is the camaraderie of, you know, the brotherhood of what you do. There's nothing relationship oriented sitting on a Greyhound bus with a bunch of people, you know, running away from home or whatever.
Yeah. Nothing until you get to Chicago and you relive Spinal Tap. And yeah, we needed 3 suites on the 5th floor. Now we have 1 suite on the,
one
room. Sorry guys. Something got screwed up. Everybody's in the same room. So now you're sharing a bed with the guitar player.
Nice.
And I told him, my good friend Tim Copes, another North Texas guy that lives out here in LA, one of the two people I knew when I moved to LA. We'll get to that later, but maybe. But I was like, Tim, you have a steady girlfriend. Not her. And I'm 22. So I'm like, and then of course, middle of the night, he like rolls over and he was like, oh. Hey, John.
Nice.
Oh, but you know, you look back with fond memories.
That's crazy, man. That's the first time I've heard a Greyhound bus. I've interviewed about 450 people. That's the first one, a Greyhound bus. Wow. Right. Welcome to the music business.
I know.
So let's talk about that. What made you move out to LA and what was that like? Like, what'd you do when you first got out there?
So we'll back up a little bit, which is, so I stayed in Dallas for about a year after I got out of school because I was playing in like a cover band, wedding band kind of situation that paid pretty well.
Yeah, as those gigs do from what I hear.
Yeah. And I had an apartment in Denton, Texas, where University of North Texas, which is like out in the middle of nowhere, pretty much, or at least it was when I went there. So I had, I shared an apartment with another guy that was $180 a month. So my rent was $90 a month.
You're kidding me.
No. So I took all the money. I lived like a pauper.
Wow. Yeah.
Shoved all that money that I, you know, all that money, whatever I made.
Well, no, but it's saving a lot of money when you're paying $90 a month rent.
I saved and saved and saved. So when I moved to LA, I, you know, had a bit of.
Yeah, you had a little bit of sleeping. Yeah, you could sleep at night.
Right. Yeah. So I drove out there with two other friends.
Good for you.
From North Texas that were moving to LA, one of which was a film composer, and another guy that ended up doing like pro audio, like mixing TV shows and stuff like that. So the three, or there was one other guy too, another drummer. So the four of us all kind of caravaned out to LA, shared an apartment. I think there was three of us in a one or two bedroom, you know, sleeping on the floor, blah, blah. I knew two people, in my LA. Buddy Tim Copsa, that was on the Joe McBride tour, and another friend. And, you know, through those guys, Tim was really helpful. He introduced me. He was, I think he was at that time getting his master's degree at USC, and he now teaches at USC. And so he sort of hooked me into that USC world. They're a pretty good music program there.
Yeah.
So I met some guys from there and, you know, sort of just said yes to everyone.
Yeah.
And
and things started growing.
Yeah. You know, it took a minute, but thankfully I had that money saved up. I went and I thought, oh, I better get a job. So I went and trained doing telemarketing.
Wow. You got a good personality and you're, you know, you're quick. So that was probably a good fit for you. Well,
thank you. But no, it was not a good fit. They were like, I did sort of the training, you know, for a few hours. And they're like, okay, here's your phone. Call
here's your script.
Some person. And I was just like, I can't do this. I got to go. Bye.
Oh, you just left. It. That's so funny,
I
man.
I was like,
what were they having you sell?
God, I don't. Honestly, I think they were surveys, maybe.
Oh.
You know? Between, you yeah. Know, yeah, I think it was sort of like, what's your feeling about this product on a scale 1 to 10 or something. I don't even remember.
Wow, she just, yeah, it wasn't your thing.
I was like, I'm out of here.
That's surprising.
I got money in the bank.
I don't need this that badly. Wow, that's wild, man. I give you credit for being disciplined enough to save as a young kid. That's not always common.
Right. Yeah. I think it was just my vision of like, hey, I want to move to LA and do this thing. And like, I just had that goal in my sights, you know, I think that's what helped.
What made you pick LA as opposed to, I guess, either New York or Nashville, maybe? You're pretty far from home, no matter what. That's the thing.
Yeah. You know, I don't remember exactly what really made me decide that. I always sort of, growing up in Alaska, there's definitely a West Coast vibe. So yeah. I felt comfortable with the West Coast.
Over New York for sure.
Yeah. And I had been to LA when I was in high school and I really liked it.
Okay.
There was just a vibe here that appealed to me. I really wanted to do studio work and stuff like that and tour as a, you know, kind of pop and rock musician, I think. And LA is the place to do that. I think I'd kind of gotten burned out on jazz a little bit at North Texas. It's so jazz.
Yeah, pretty much.
I kind of was starting to kind of move away from wanting to be a jazz guy. And I felt like New York, I think, was more jazzy.
Yes.
So I think that was some of the parts of my decision, but I don't remember exactly what really made me decide. But
well, man, I got to give you credit because you actually lived your vision and your dream. And, you know, as a guy on the outside, I have so much respect for all the guys and gals I interview that have done that because that's, it takes a lot of courage and it's, you know, It's just really cool. I think not many people do that.
Yeah, I feel very fortunate. Thank you for saying that. And yeah. There was an article in my hometown newspaper. I must have been about 12 or something. And they interviewed me about, you know, whatever music and stuff. And I said in that, like, oh, I want to, you know, move to LA and be a studio musician.
Oh, so you had this vision for quite a while.
Oh, yeah.
That's awesome, man. Yeah. That's really cool. Do you do, is that like your makeup naturally? Do you naturally just sort of like, I don't want to sound all LA, like manifest things, you know,
right.
But like, you know, there are people like, I don't know if you, do you know Mike Keneally?
Yeah.
So I interviewed Mike and he had this whole thing. He's like different next level, like intellectually. And he had this like crystal vision of him wanting to play for Frank Zappa. And it's almost like he made it happen. I mean, literally.
Interesting. Yeah.
And so I mean, this is the same thing that you're saying.
Yeah. I feel like for me, that kind of thing, for whatever reason, just came very naturally and sort of almost subconsciously. It wasn't like a real sort of figured out conscious, like I'm going to do this and that will lead to this. I think I just something naturally, I just sort of, like I say, subconsciously do that naturally or something.
That's great. Yeah. I'm really happy. Yeah, for that, man. That's really cool. Really cool. Well, the nice thing is too, now, you know, you could bring that kind of mindset to your son. Well, that's the cool thing about it now, you know,
right.
Thinking about things and sort of like, again, not to sound, you know, silly, but manifesting them or, you know, organically making them happen, you know, is the norm for him, which is what I think is really
maybe.
Cool. Yeah. I think that's really cool. Yeah. You never know. Trust me. man. So let me talk about, I'm going to throw some names of, or some artists out there that you have worked with. And if you could talk about how you get the gig and a cool or interesting story about working with them, man, let's start with The Who, because that's like one of the greatest gigs in the world, man. I mean, honestly, it really is.
Yeah, I know. Seriously. It's crazy. It's still, I mean, I started with them in 2017. So that was a couple of years ago. And it's still just like, so it doesn't seem real. It's so weird to me. People are like, oh, hey, man, nice to meet you. Who do you play with? And I'm just like, you feel like you'd be like, oh my God, I play with The Who. But for me, I'm just like, it feels so awkward because like people just don't believe you. And then they're just like all super excited and treat you different. And it's just like, oh, this is so awkward and weird. I mean, don't get me wrong. It's a fantastic problem to have. But
totally
just for
me,
I'm a humble guy and it just always feels awkward. And like, I honestly kind of keep it on the DL, like at my school where my kid goes to school and stuff. I try to like not tell people because then they just get weird.
Oh yeah. Then they'll be like, shh, shh. And then they're like, oh, hi, John.
You know, it's like, I hate that. I just like, but anyway.
A quick story on that. Do you know Guy Pratt, bass player?
Yeah. Yeah.
Guy, and he's actually friends with Pete.
Sure,
me. So for people listening, I interviewed Guy, and his interview, I don't know when it's coming out, but he has been playing with Pink Floyd and Gilmour since Roger Waters left. Tony Levin came in for, I think, the first album, and then he's been the bass player. Anyway, he's been around a long time, and he said a comment to me, and I asked him a question, something about, how have you changed? Because I think I've changed because most of my life I felt like I'm going to get found out soon. Like kind of like what you were saying in a way, because like, you know, that, you know, they're going to find me out that I shouldn't be on all these gigs and like I'm going to get outed.
Every artist has that feeling, right? I think, or a lot of us do, you know.
90%, 75% for sure. And he goes, and I'm at the point now where I'm like, I'm okay. I'm not worried about being outed anymore. And he's maybe a couple of years older than me.
Yeah.
So, but that's reminding me of what you said, because he's up there with Gilmour. You're up there with Townsend and Roger. It's the same thing. It's like, what the hell? How?
Yeah, I see pictures of myself with them. I'm just like, really? Yeah. I guess there's a photo of it. So
it must be real.
Yeah. So I think you asked how'd you get the gig? The gig. So I got the gig with Roger first, almost 10 years ago. Because Roger does, when The Who's not touring, Roger wants to, you know, he wants to keep singing and keep out there, be out there doing it. Pete wasn't touring enough for Roger. So Roger was like, oh, let me do a solo band and get out there and do it. So a dear friend of mine, amazing guitar player, Pete Thorne, he recommended me to audition. His friend Frank Symes was helping put the band together for Roger.
Yeah, I got LA Frank coming to my show soon.
Oh, cool. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So Pete recommended me to Frank. Frank was like, hey, do you know any bass players? We're putting together this Roger Daltrey tour. And Pete was like, hey, my buddy John would be great. So I auditioned with, you know, 150,000 other LA musicians, and I wound up getting that gig with Roger. So I played with Roger, you know, for years. In 2017, Pino Palladino, who had been playing with The Who since John Entwistle passed away, The Who didn't have a ton of work in 2017, 2018. And so Pino was like, I've got this nonstop year and a half world tour with John Mayer paying me apparently a handsome sum of money. So I'm going to go do that. And so The Who were like, who's going to play bass? And Roger was like, hey, Pete, get my guy, John. He's a nice guy and it's an okay bass player. And you know. So then
you are humble, man.
They had,
you're really humble, because I'll tell you what, you're playing with one of the brightest ever human beings to write and create music in Pete Townsend, and he could have anybody up there, man. So fucking genius, that guy, man.
I totally agree. But the initial thing with The Who was they had like a 2-week tour in England and then subsequent stuff after that. And so it was put to me like, hey, we'll do these 2 weeks, see how it goes, you know, see how Pete likes you, see how you fit in with the band.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then of course, like towards the end of the 2-week tour, the road crew is like, hey, so how do you want to ship your gear to the next? I'm like, nobody's told, like, you know, just
don't do
along.
This, guys. Come on.
So I had to like go to them and be like, so
am I off double secret probation or what?
Yeah, exactly.
And everything worked out.
I guess I wasn't. Yeah,
that's great, man. Congratulations. I'm real happy for you, man. That's really
thank
cool.
Thank you. I mean, it's dream come true. What gig could be better than, I mean, it's just like,
I gotta ask
craziest thing on the planet.
One fanboy question. The first time you're on stage and you hear like any classic Who song, and you know, you got Pete on one side and Roger on the other side, or I don't know how you're standing, like, you know, like Baba O'Reilly or anything from Who's Next, anything that you listen to in your kid, what was going through your mind?
Don't screw up. Keep it together. Don't screw this up.
That had to be incredibly like weird, right?
It is. Yeah. I mean, with The Who, I kind of eased into it because I had 10 years of listening to Roger's voice.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
You know? Okay. So I kind of eased into it.
Yeah.
But
okay.
I mean, honestly, just Pete's energy. He is an intense dude.
Yeah.
And just looking across the stage and see, I mean, when he plays, he is in it 110%. He's almost like possessed.
Yeah.
It's pretty amazing. And just to sort of be part of that spirit is incredible. And can be a little intimidating, but
yeah. Man, I'm so happy for you, man. That's great.
Thank you.
That's really cool. I'm very happy for you, man. And you know, that's awesome.
Yeah.
I hope you come to Tampa. For selfish reasons, I'd love to come see you guys play. I got to see the Who sometime before I...
Yeah, come on. I'll let you know. I think we are.
Really?
Maybe. Yeah, I forget. Well,
that's awesome.
Look at the schedule. I think we're down there at some point.
Sheryl Crow.
Okay, that's actually the how I got that gig. That is kind of interesting, I think. I had done about a year and a half, 2 years, I think 2 years with Shakira. Mm. So that tour wrapped up. So then it's like, well, what do I do now? And
you must have, let me cut you off, but you must have really good hanging skills and really good stage presence, because these are all like top. You know, these guys didn't just fall off a log. These artists you're working with, man, these guys are like top performers, man. So that's good for you, man. That's really cool.
You. Well, you mentioned hang skills. I mean, that's criteria one.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know if I have, I'm a nice guy. I'm easy to get along with.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
I don't cause trouble, you know, and that's huge, because I mean, there are so many great players that are all just standing in line. If you're a jerk out on the road, I mean, you're in close quarters all the time, you know, for 2 years straight. If you're a stinker,
yeah,
there's, you know, 20 nice guys that could probably play circles around you that
you're right behind you.
Yeah.
But you've also got to have great stage presence too, because these are really top acts. And I'm not like saying it to blow smoke up your ass. I'm just saying it as a statement of fact. You know, this is not amateur hour that you're talking about here, man.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I've definitely spent my 10,000 hours on stage.
Yeah. Well, I'm saying I know you've worked at it. It's not like, you know, oh, I'm just, you know, there. I know it's something that you have to, everything is something. I mean, with rare exception for rare people, everything is pretty much something you have to work on. You know, it's not just like, you know, I have great stage presence. Okay. You know,
right. Yeah. I mean, I think part of having good stage presence is just being comfortable and having just put in the hours, just been, you know, I've spent a lot of time on stage.
I think when, like, to me, what makes a good concert's a transference of energy, right?
Yes.
So
right.
It's a transference of energy. As a guy in the audience, I want that transference. When I get a transference of energy from the performers, that gets me juiced. And I'm assuming you guys on stage, when you're feeling it from the audience, that gets you juiced. So you have to be able to put that out in a very definite way.
Yeah.
There's an art to that. You just can't lay there like a lox and then, like, you know, it just doesn't happen, you know? Right. I mean, we've all seen it, and like, move, please, you know, do something, smile, you know, I mean, like, pretend you're happy, you know. It's really funny, I saw a gig, and I don't want to say who it was, but really well-known guitar player with a well-known band, and man, it was, you know, band from the like 80s, real loads of hits, and the guy was just like going through the motions. It was just awful. It was so disappointing. And he's one of my like favorite players, and I was like, please, I don't want to be seeing this. You know, I'm hoping that he just had a bad night or whatever. But
that could be. I mean, if you're not enjoying yourself on stage, then all that stuff you talked about is just...
He was miserable, man. He was absolutely miserable. You could see it. So
I think part of it for me is I love what I do.
Yeah.
You know, it's not a conscious thing of like, oh, I have to have my stage presence. I think I'm just happy to be up there. Yeah. I'm comfortable. You know, for me, that's what works.
Yeah. Sorry, but, man. Sheryl Crow.
That's right.
2 years Sheryl with Crow. Shakira.
So 2 years.
What's
with Shakira.
Next?
What do I do now? And I turn on the TV and I see my buddy Mike Elizondo playing bass with Sheryl Crow on TV. And previous to that, Sheryl had always played bass herself. She's a very good bass player.
Oh, I didn't know that.
So on a lot of her tours, so she would play bass.
That's interesting.
And she had a guitar player that doubled on bass. So between the two of them, they'd cover the bass duties. So then I see on TV, I see my friend Mike Elizondo, amazing bass player, playing bass with her. But Mike, at that time, was also becoming, or had become at that time, a big producer, songwriter, like bass had sort of he's a brilliant bass player, but he had sort of moved on to like big time. I mean, he like co-wrote 50 Cent's big, like,
oh, wow,
In the Club song.
Holy shit.
He had co-produced stuff with Dr. Dre. Like, I'm talking, you know, like.
Yeah, that's big.
Huge, huge. And at that time, I mean, you know, that was, when was that? Like, early 2000s. Like, I mean, he must have made a zillion dollars. So there he is playing bass with Sheryl Crow. I'm like, he's not going to go on tour with Sheryl Crow when he's, you know, like, producing 50 Cent, right?
Right.
So I call Mike, and I'm like, hey, man, I just got off this Shakira tour. So I'm kind of looking for a gig. If you hear of anything, you know, any gigs pop up that you think I might be good for, that they might need a bass player, you know, give me a shot. Cool. Leave, you know, He calls me back like, hey, funny you should call. I'm doing this Shakira gig, or this Sheryl Crow gig, and I'm probably not going to do the tour now. So I'll put your name in the hat.
Wow. Yeah. See, but man, you know what? People don't realize a lot of people would be afraid to make that call.
As was I.
But you did
it. I mean, there was part
of it. Of course you're afraid, but you did it.
Yeah.
You did it, man. And you changed your destiny because of that. You know, so, absolutely. You know, awesome to you.
Yeah. And so then the audition process was really crazy because Sheryl lives in Nashville. Her drummer and her keyboard player were living in London.
Oh, wow.
Her guitar players live in Atlanta. So you can't just like, hey, let's get the boys together and have a bass audition.
Yeah.
So what they had to do was have the bass audition on day one, and then rehearsals start day two. And then day five or six, like, there's a show in New York. And then day eight, there's a show in London. So she auditioned three bass players. The other two guys are very good friends of mine, Brett Simons and Why Not Jansfield, amazing bass players. And so all three of us had to have our bags packed.
Oh, wow.
Have a visa for the show in London.
Like, that's stressful, man.
Yeah. And awkward. I mean, those Brett.
Yeah. And then you're sitting there with your luggage. And if you don't get the go,
that's, you gotta take your bags and go home.
Yeah, it's like the little kid getting kicked out of the club or something, man. That's awful.
I know. And yeah. And like I say, I mean, why not? I didn't know him well at the time. He's become a good friend. Brett's one of my dearest friends. You know, we're sitting on the plane across from each other, like, may the best man win.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Sure.
I mean, playing with Sheryl was like totally a dream for me. Like, I am a big fan of her music.
Yes, great,
I opened for her with, I was playing with Michelle Branch, I think.
Oh, wow.
And we did a tour opening for Sheryl. I would watch them every night and like, oh man, that's a cool gig. Like, and I got word of the audition probably about a month in advance. So I worked on that stuff. Like, I was like, I am getting this gig.
Right.
This is going to change my life. This gig, nothing is standing in my way.
Dude, there you go. You need to be a motivational speaker now, man. That's your, if this, John Button, if this doesn't work, you come see me. We'll do plan B. Right. I'm a marketing guy, man. I've worked in 110 industries. Seriously, that's my, I've run a marketing company for 20 years. We'll get you,
oh, wow.
We'll get you up and freaking running. You'll be the new guru.
Oh my God. But yeah, so for a month, I literally probably worked on Sheryl Crow music for like 8 hours a day.
That's great.
I would,
I love hearing,
record myself playing along with it, listen back. Nah, not quite good enough. Need to do this, need to do that. So when I came into the audition, I like,
you were so prepared, over prepared probably.
Way over
prepared. Yeah, that's great. That's great.
It was like I've been on tour with them for 2 years.
Man, you can't beat work ethic. I don't think so anyway. That's the best trait someone could have.
Well, being prepared.
Yeah. That's great, man.
Yeah.
That's so cool. Who was her guitar player then?
Tim Smith was one guitar player and oh my God, really? Am I actually Pete Stroud?
Oh, right. He's still with her. Peter Stroud is still with her, yeah.
Yeah,
right.
Man, he's amazing.
Yeah, he's
amazing guitar player and a sweetheart of a guy.
Jason played with her for a minute, didn't he?
Did he? I don't know. I
think he played. He's played with a lot of female artists, so I get confused.
He very well could. Yeah, could have. Yeah, not while I was doing it, but yeah, that's possible.
And so how long were you with Cheryl for? That whole tour?
Yeah, I think it was about 2 years.
That's a lot, man.
Yeah. She actually, at the end of those 2 years, she had had guys with her. Some of those guys were with her for like, I think Tim Smith had been with her for 18 years or something like that. She let everybody go and decided, I want to do something totally different. She did like kind of a Atlantic soul R&B kind of thing. She just sort of reinvented herself for a minute.
Yeah. Hey, welcome to the music business. You're all fired.
Yeah. I mean, she was, you know.
Yeah, I know. You guys did great. You're fired. Thank you for your hard work.
Yeah.
No, it's just the way the business works, man.
And then, you know, and then I was in that spot again where you're like, wow, Sheryl Crow, what, you know, what, how do you top that? What do you do next?
And then what is that when Rogers?
Yeah.
Dude, so you just
next, yeah.
Yeah, that was awesome. That's so cool, man. That's great. How about Robin Ford?
I only did a few things with Robin. I was recommended to him by an amazing drummer named Tos Panos.
Yeah, I know.
Who is one of the, I think, kind of most underrated, most misunderstood drummers in LA.
Yeah, he's a great drummer.
He's unbelievable. But he had been playing with Robin for a long time, and for whatever reason, Robin needed a bass player to fill in for a few gigs. So I did that. It was sort of while I was doing the Cheryl gig, there was like a break with Cheryl, and I kind of slipped in and did a few Robin gigs, cool. Which was kind of amazing. I mean, to be playing with Robin Ford and Cheryl Crow at the same time.
Just subbing with Robin, that's not a bad deal, man.
I was like, well, this is kind of, I remember being like in the hotel room on the Cheryl tour, like learning Robin Ford tunes. I was just like, wow, this is amazing.
Good for you, man. Like,
yeah.
Do you know Brian Allen? Bass player?
No, I don't.
Okay, he played with Robin for a while. He's a originally West Coast guy. Anyway, what made you, just one quickly, you started on piano. What made you switch over to bass?
So all my siblings started on piano and moved to other instruments.
Okay.
So I was like, that's what you do.
Yeah, that makes total sense.
So,
yeah.
I mean, I don't know. And the reason I switched to bass was because my oldest brother, the drummer, he was trying to like get bands together in Fairbanks, Alaska, and there weren't many dudes around, and they could never find a bass player. He, you know, there was like 8 drummers and 13 guitar players, you know, and he would jam with people, just him playing drums and the guitar player, and they're like, there's no bass player. So he bought a bass and learned how to play bass so he could be the bass player. And he was 10 years older than me, so I was 6 and he was 16.
Oh, that's really cool to grow up with kids that much older than you, man.
Yeah. And he, cool. I mean, he was so generous to like, you know, he bought this expensive bass and sure, 6-year-old brother. Yeah.
Yeah. That is
go
really cool.
Yeah. Right. And I still have that bass. It's a beautiful,
that is really nice. That's really nice.
So he, you know, he showed me some things and would let me play around with it. And my mom, being the brilliant person that she is, she was like, oh, you should join the school orchestra, you know, and learn to play string bass. So sure enough, 3rd grade.
Wow.
I hop into the – and thankfully, growing up in Alaska, tons of oil money.
Right, right.
So we were want of nothing in our school.
In school. That's great.
So orchestra in 3rd grade with a great teacher – I started playing in the orchestra, learning to read music, doing the whole thing.
That's great, man.
So cool. I was taking string bass lessons, learning classical stuff, and then at home, you know, picking out songs off of records and on the electric bass. And, yeah.
Very cool. Do your brothers and sisters still live in Alaska or do they leave?
One is still up there and then the rest are scattered all over the globe.
Wow. It sounds like you've been really smart about things in general and really diligent. Is there any advice like that you would have given to your younger self that would have made things easier for you, either business or personally?
I would say maybe I would have worked on singing earlier. Because as a touring sideman, being a great singer especially as a bass player, I think is a real asset.
Yeah.
And I'm okay. You know, I've sang backing vocals on a lot of tours that I've done.
Come on, show me.
I'm okay.
Let's do something. No, I'm just kidding.
me. Let me just warm up. But like, I'm a just kind of okay singer. And I work with guys that are just awesome singers, and I'm often jealous of their abilities as a singer. So I kind of wish I'd like maybe taken lessons and stuff as a kid.
Sure. Singer,
that'd be one regret.
Yeah, that's like almost like a career move. There's no way you would have ever known that. Like, make sure you work on your background vocals.
Yeah, well, especially, when I was in high school, I wanted to be like a jazz upright player,
I need to ever open your mouth ever, exactly. Ever, ever.
I got to work on my my minor 2/5s.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
Fears, you know,
holy. So. How does Roger keep his voice like that, man? Does he like? Is that just? Does he do a lot of exercises, or is he just like blessed with these?
I think there. He doesn't. I don't. I don't see, he does not seem to do like vocal exercises and warm up as typical singers that I know do. I think he does do some stuff. Part of it is just he wants to keep out there and keep singing. That's part of the reason that he does his solo tours, is he's afraid if he doesn't go out, and he feels like there's no way he can replicate being on tour by practicing on his own or sitting at home singing.
Wow, he's the like, energy is not.
Yeah,
you're not like, going to push the way you're going to put. You know, you're going to do stand in front of a mirror and scream.
Right. So
you do that for a measure.
Yeah.
Or exactly. Chorus, you know, or something like that, but not.
And for one of his solo tours was called "Use It or Lose It," which was basically saying like he has to stay out there doing it to keep his instrument in shape. But also, he has had several surgeries.
Oh, wow.
He has this guy. There's a guy in Boston that's a miracle worker with vocal cord surgery. And he also – he's worked on a lot of famous singers that have had issues. But he's also helped like – cancer patients that have lost their voice and helped them.
Wow, that's great.
Super
that's
amazing.
That's really cool. Very cool, man.
And I don't know exactly what he does, but he's helped Roger a lot. And in fact, when I first started with Roger, we started rehearsals and Roger was having a lot of trouble with his voice. And I was like, how is this going to go? Like it was rough at the beginning. And then he got one of his surgeries, and it's like you could hear, like when he came back and talk, you could hear it in his voice when he talked. His voice was like tighter and like not as growly. Oh, and so I think that's a definite big part of it is this surgeon.
That's great, man. One of the greatest, if not the greatest voice ever in rock
and
roll, man.
Still, he sounds amazing. I mean, he sounds better now than he did 10 years ago when I started with him. He sounds incredible now.
That's cool,
he's
man.
Killing it. Yeah.
Let's talk about music for a little bit. Have you seen any really good concerts? Like, what are the top 2 or 3 concerts you've seen?
Oh my goodness. So we just did one of these concert like cruises.
Yeah, yeah.
With Daltrey. It was called the Legends of Rock Cruise, and there was a ton of bands on it. And I saw. I mean, you know, this is off the top of my head because I just saw them like what a week or two ago. But Buddy Guy was on the tour, and he has, you can tell that he's been doing it for so long and like being in front of an audience, he has the audience like clay in the palm of his hand. He, like his banter between songs, all his just interaction with the audience. I mean, on top of it, he still sounds great.
Yeah. He shreds.
Like, oh my, he's got a lot of fire.
Yeah. Really does.
And he's like, sorry, he's old as dirt.
No, he's got to be like close to 80. Very close to 80. Because I remember when he came out with that song, I'm 74 years young. That's got to be close to, he might be over 80.
I think he is.
Yeah.
I mean, and he seems like he's in good shape. Yeah. I mean, you can definitely tell he's, you know, no spring chicken. But anyway, he was amazing. Seeing him just as a stage presence, like we were talking about before.
Yeah.
Like, he was amazing. And then also Eric Gales was on that tour. Dude.
Yeah, he's a monster player.
I've been aware of him for a while, but I had never seen him live. Wow.
Yeah.
That dude. To me, his combination of, like, he's lived the blues.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Like, he's been to prison and, like, I don't know what all. He's had a life.
Yeah, so I think he's got sober and stuff like that.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. That comes out in his playing. But on top of that, that combination of that sort of history and heart and soul that he has combined with this technical ability, it seems pretty rare, that combination to me.
He's a really good player. I need to get with him and get him on the show.
Yeah, he would probably have a lot of interesting stuff. I mean, his life, I don't know his story. I just know it's checkered.
Yeah. He's lived the blues, man. I think it was a good thing that you said it, man.
Who else were some great concerts? God, it's hard to, think off the top of my head. But those are a couple of recent ones.
Which Buddy was there? Because, you know, I've seen Buddy four or five times, and it's always a different, like, sometimes it's the Buddy guy who's like kind of buzzed, you know, and he's hammered actually, or whatever. And motherfucker. And he's like, he's got to be out of his mind. Like, I don't know what he was drinking. And then there's, you know, the other Buddy guy, you know, and he's always a fiery, great player. The playing is never different. It's just which personality shows up on any given.
Yeah. Night. I think it was somewhere in between. He definitely was, you know.
Yeah. He's
he had a couple drinks, but not too many.
Yeah. Right.
It seemed, it was good.
Any interesting or cool stories behind how you got any of your basses?
Sure. Yeah. Well, so my dear oldest brother that got me my first bass, he was at Berkeley in Boston. And I was up there in Alaska and, kind of wanting to move from a Rickenbacker, you know, I was getting into Daryl Jones and Marcus Miller. And so I needed a Fender jazz bass. Mm-hmm. So I rang him up and said, you know, it's hard to, you know, you can't find a vintage jazz bass in Fairbanks, Alaska.
There's really not a ton of music stores there, is there?
No, I mean, there are a couple, but it's limited.
Do they even, do they have like a postal service there even?
Yeah.
No, I'm just kidding.
I mean, it was, it's, when I was young, it
probably
was
probably remote, right?
It was pretty backwards. Yeah, like, you know, we only had a couple TV channels and like all our movies were second run movies.
Really?
And,
wow.
I mean, when you ordered something, it took like a month.
It was like shipping it to England.
Literally took a month. You know, it wasn't
wild.
Amazon next day delivery, you know? So it was definitely, I remember getting a telephone. Like, before that, we had like a weird ham radio. Like,
are you serious? Really?
Yeah,
it's very remote.
That's not an outlandish question.
Wow. Wow.
But anyway, so no vintage
P bases up in Fairbanks.
Yeah. So I asked my brother if he would find a vintage jazz bass for me. And so I think he had maybe a bass player friend of his help him out. You know, Boston, they're around. Yeah. And he managed to find a great sort of Frankenstein, I think. I'm not sure to this day whether the headstock's Candy Apple Red, the body's black. I think the body might have been refinned.
Okay.
It definitely was refinned. I don't know if at some point the body and the headstock match, whatever. Anyway, because it was all, you know, Frankensteined out, it was $500.
Wow.
And it was marked as a 66 jazz
Holy
bass.
Smokes.
Yeah. Turned out later on, I figured out after I took it apart and looked at the stamp on it, it's a 64 jazz
wow.
bass. $500. Brother, I send my brother $500, gets me my 64. Thought it was a 66, it was a 64. And mails it up to Alaska. I get it. It's still in tune.
You're kidding me.
From Boston to Alaska, I vividly remember. I
that
out.
Is really bad. That's like really exciting when you pick that up, man.
Oh, my God.
You got to think, wow, what am I getting into here? This is wonderful.
That's a great, great bass. Yeah. So, I mean, that carried me through college and everything and out here. And yeah. Right. I mean, I'm kind of more of a P bass guy these days. So my beloved jazz bass doesn't get a lot of action these days. But, yeah. But
dude, your brother's giving you the hookup, man. Good guy.
Absolutely. For sure. Yeah.
Name a couple of guitar players that you've enjoyed playing with.
Pete Townsend. I mean, seriously. I mean,
oh my God. Yeah.
He is a force, man. Yeah, like,
he is.
It's kind of, it's amazing, man, when he, you know, like his rhythm playing, his sense of time.
Yeah. He's such.
Is yeah. a. Astounding. It is a serious thing. I mean, and that actually reminds me, Sheryl Crow, her time, I mean, she is an incredible musician. She knows her stuff. But, you know, she, when she sits up, stands up there and, you know, starts a song on acoustic guitar, the tempo is perfect. Every night, her time is impeccable. Like, you know who else? Steve Stevens. I've done a fair bit of stuff playing with Steve. Dude, that guy, another, I mean, I'm sensitive to time as a rhythm section bass player guy.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Steve, like.
He's on top of it?
Yeah, well, not on top of it. He's like in the pocket.
You know what I mean. He's in the pocket.
But yeah, I mean, I think that's kind of what separates the men from the boys in a way, or the girls from the women.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's from your perspective. I could totally that's real important to you.
Yeah. And I think to everyone as an audience, like if a band's up there, everybody's rushing and it doesn't sound tough and big. And there's something about when everybody's like kind of on the backside of the beat, it's just everything sounds kind of tough and big and like in command. Doesn't sound like it gets light in the loafers if it gets too on top and everybody's nervous and frantic and it just kind of sounds immature to me.
Well, you guys having been playing together for 10 years probably sound fantastic because time is a big factor in that. In I saw The Fix. Do you remember that band, The Fix?
Sure, absolutely. Yeah.
So this is really weird. I interviewed Jamie Westorm, who's their guitar player, and like he goes, hey, we're going to be in the States in Clearwater, which is like, I'm in Tampa. It's like,
I played there.
Yeah. Okay. So, and I was like,
wait, Ruth Acker?
No. They actually did an out. That's a great venue. I love that place. But they were doing like some outdoor thing, but like, he goes, we're like two gigs we're doing one in Clearwater. I'm like
that's weird.
Great. But I mean, how weird is that? And it was like a week or 2 weeks after he goes, so I came to see them and, my God, those guys have been playing together since like 81. And it's the same five guys in the band.
Oh, wow. Right.
I don't think I'd ever, maybe the Grateful Dead. I saw them like way the hell back. That's the only other band that the unity those guys had. It was like uncanny, you know, and then I'm sure the Who is the same thing, you know, well, you know, they're kind of scattered, but you know,
yeah. But, I think if Keith and John were still around,
oh my God.
I mean, not to take anything away from us ringers that, you know, do our best, but, that would be, if they were still around, that would be along those lines.
Yeah. Time has a lot to do with that, you know?
Yeah, and, I agree. And I think also, sometimes a lot of that can be just, if both of you feel it in the same place to begin with,
yeah,
there's that,
right.
You know, I know with Keith Carlock, we talked about, he and I felt the beat in the same place from minute one. It was like, yeah, boom, we're locked. Just, you know, we coincidentally felt it in the same place.
Mm.
And that's huge.
Yeah, that is huge. It's, I think there's something to being an original member, but, you know, to creating something.
For sure.
I think there's, someone once said to me, they had their husband passed, and then they had a new relationship, and they said something. They said, look, I really enjoy this, but I'll never have, like, my wife and I've been together 26 years. And they said, I'll never have what, you know, the memories to look back on, that foundation that you guys have. And I guess maybe this musically, it's kind of like that, you know.
Undoubtedly. Yeah, totally. Yeah, that's a special thing. Like, you're talking about a band that has been playing together with all the original guys for so long. I guess you too.
Yeah, right.
Would be along those lines, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah, pretty special thing.
Sorry, I didn't mean to go off on a tangent. So you're saying Pete, Sheryl Crow, Steve Stevens, anybody else that you've enjoyed playing with?
Oh, I mean, the list could probably go on and on. Nobody jumps out at me off the top of my head at the moment, but
yeah. No, all good, man. This tough question. What are some of the more important things you've learned about yourself, John, throughout your life experience and doing all the things you've done?
I think on the positive side that I'm a preparer. I love to be prepared, in all aspects. My hiking buddies make fun of me because I always have three extra jackets, and and two extra sandwiches, and
that's,
you know,
great.
And they make all kinds of fun of me until it starts raining halfway through the hike and I'm hungry. And they're like, oh, thank God John's here.
John. I was only kidding.
Yeah, exactly. You know, I go camping with the family and, you know, I've got a car filled with like tools and rope and like survival equipment. And, you know, I live in LA. I've got the earthquake kit and the, you know, don't tell anybody my address, but I've got all the extra water and the generator. And, you know, I'm not a prepper. But
I was just going to say that he's a prepper.
Yeah. No, I don't have.
I have 4,000 cans of food in my basement.
Yeah, exactly. But anyway, I mean, I think that's a big part of my personality, and one that has helped me a lot in my career. Yeah,
absolutely.
I love to be prepared. And
are you organized? You're organized too, I would imagine.
Yeah, I'm a bit OCD.
To a fault. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm like.
I think you can't. I don't know how people. I'm not OCD, but I'm really well organized. I don't know how people function. Like, I don't know how people ever run a business, or like you're a business owner.
Absolutely.
I mean, I don't know how people run businesses when they're not organized. There's so many moving parts, and especially if you're a small business owner, you're wearing a lot of hats. And
That's right. And
to me, being organized makes so much life so much easier, man.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, just down to like, okay, you're about to start with the Who. You have 60 songs to make sure you know. So
yeah.
I've got spreadsheets of,
yeah, I'm going to do these two this day, and it's going to take me this long and go.
Absolutely. And I have like a number system of like, you know, how prepared I am on each song. This one's a 5 out of 10. I better work on that. This one's a 10 out of 10 because it's easy. So I skip, you know, like.
I'm like that too, because it takes, for me, if you had to like constantly think of this shit every day, it's like really difficult. It takes the management. It creates a systematic way of approaching things so that you could bite the elephant, you know, eat the elephant one bite at a time, sort of.
Correct. Yeah. And you got to streamline your time, you know, like if you're trying to like shuffle through, like spend time figuring out which song you need to work on or whatever, you know, like you're wasting time that you need because, you know, you don't have all the time in the world to get all that stuff together.
No, man. I always say you can make more money. You cannot make more time, you know?
Yeah, that's a good one. I like that.
Yeah, you could take it.
I receive that and I'm taking it. So I'm prepared. I'm organized.
That's great, man.
Wait, so remind me of the question.
The question was, what most, I know we're going off on all over the board. Most important things you've learned about yourself throughout your life experience.
Oh, right. Most important things. Yeah. Yeah, I guess. And also, you know, like we talked about the kind of subconscious secret manifesty kind of stuff. I mean, I've learned that about myself, that to be a little bit on the secret kind of tip, there's something about when I feel confident about something that sort of helps me be able to focus on it, be able to think like I can realistically accomplish that goal.
That's wonderful, dude.
So, you know, like calling my friend and going, hey, I didn't say, hey, you want to give me the Sheryl Crow gig? But in the back of my head, I was calling to say, hey, give me the Sheryl Crow gig.
Yeah, yeah.
To have the, you know, I have to, in my bones, feel, yes, I can do that gig. That is realistic. And part of that feeling for me comes from the work.
Yeah, being prepared.
And just getting my playing together, making sure I'm confident in my playing so I can, like, get on the phone and be like, yo, yeah, let's do this. I'm ready.
No, I think that's I've been in sales various capacities for my, you know, for 30 years, and my wife came in the other day and she said, what are you doing? I said, I'm preparing for this meeting. She said, but you've done this a million times. I said, yeah, but I've been prepared for all of them. You know, it doesn't mean it's gonna work. But if I'm not prepared, it's definitely not gonna work, you know. I mean, in my mind anyway, you know, I mean, yeah, I could wing it, but you know, I'd rather wing it on a vacation than in a business meeting, you know, that I need to be prepared for.
Right. Yeah. So
that's good, man.
I didn't get all the questions answered, but
you're very well prepared. Dude, so tell me some questions that you want. Since you did all that work, let me accommodate. I could accommodate all this effort you've done. I'm trying to figure out a snarky question to ask you now that's related to preparation and writing all that stuff down. A lot of people do that. Some people do. I think a lot of people usually have some answers down there because there's so many questions and I never know what I'm going to ask. You know, it's kind of like a surprise to me.
You know, some of the things, you know, you just space, you know, a person's name or a, like, whatever.
Well, you're not thinking about that stuff all day, you know, like what are your biggest struggles or something like that, and you're like, yeah, oh, hang on. What about the flip? Okay, so that's probably what you like most about yourself. How about the flip side? Anything about yourself you'd want to change? And by the way, you are a very nice guy. You're one of the easiest guys to hang out. I could see why, you know.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Super easy. I think sometimes I might be nice to a fault. So yeah, I could be not so nice all the time, you know, try not to be a doormat.
I hear you.
That's a
lot of people that are nice have that issue.
It can be a fine line to walk, you know, to not get trampled on.
I always try to be fair. And to me, fair means being fair to you and fair to me.
Totally. That's a great way to look at it. I like that.
Yeah and it's really helped me. That's because I'm really very fair in business, and like if there's a point where I'm like, this is ridiculous, I'll just say, hey, listen guys, that's it, we're done. I'm really a fair person, and I'm very confident in that. I don't know how I know I'm fair, but I feel like that, and I'm like, hey, this is where we're at. It's important to be fair to you, but it's important to be fair to me.
Totally.
If that doesn't work, that's totally cool. I respect that.
Right.
And I mean it, because like, I'm not going to be fair, unfair to myself, because like, then I'm going to hate what I'm doing. You know, I'm going
to
hate myself.
I totally relate to that. Yeah. Absolutely. I think I've gotten better at that over the years. Mm. And I mean, I don't have a manager or an agent or anything. So like when I book a gig, sometimes it's just me on the phone with some, you know, sharky manager, like trying to negotiate my fee for the tour, you know? And I can relate to that. Yeah. And I've definitely, there have been tours in the past where I just had to say like, no, that's not going to work for me. And see you later.
And that's it, man.
And then 2 days later they call back. I'm like, okay.
And 99% of the time, the same thing happens. They're like, okay, we're good. You know, And that only validates, you know, sort of like my threshold there, you know, like I know we're good. And if you don't think so, this is not, you know, your problems are not my problems sort of thing, you know?
Right.
This guy interviewed a really good guitar player named Ben Yardley, and he plays with a band called La Chinga out of Canada. They're sort of like a stoner rock band. And he's a guy who got sober. And one of the things he got, a lot of people who are involved in drugs, they have issues. They're like, they want to please other people. And that whole, this whole thing is tough for them. You know,
interesting.
When to say no. And he said, hang on a second. I just want to say what he said before I forget it. He said he had this thing and he said, I realized how you feel about me is none of my business.
Interesting.
And I was like, man, that was really cool. How you feel about me is not my business. Like, it's your shit. You know, how you feel about me is not my business. You know, me from the Bronx, I'd be like, you know, this is your problem. How you feel about me is your problem, you know, not mine. And you're entitled to that, but I'm not making your problems my problems, you know?
Right.
And
interesting. That's good.
Yeah, I thought that was really cool. Sorry, were you going to say something about getting sober?
Or something? Doesn't matter.
No, about getting sober and then like,
doesn't matter.
I think we're all getting sober in some way or another. No, seriously. Right. I mean, like, life is not easy, man. I mean, you might not be getting sober from drugs, but like, you know, you got to figure this shit out. It's not like
hopefully you're improving yourself.
Right.
Not, you know.
Yeah. Right.
I think, you know, actually, you and the initial question was what things I might
change
about myself. I think another thing would be to not worry about things so much. I can tend to sort of stress a little bit or worry about every minute detail. And I think that's for everyone. As they get older, you start just like, worrying about stuff less. You just like, you know, let the rain roll off the duck's back to, you know, as time goes on.
100%. Cause you realize how much stress you're making, and you're like, at least for me, one day I just literally woke up and said, I realized how much stress in my life was not the universe's fault, but was me. And I'm like, and it was like turning off a light switch. I said, you know, I'm done. And it was just like that. I was done. And I was just like, so it was like taking a 1 million pound weight off my shoulders, and I'm like, bye. And and now
I feel like my dad's getting really good at that. He's, man, 85. I
think. Yeah.
And it's just like, I don't got time for that.
Right. That's pretty much what it is.
He doesn't seem to worry about much. Nothing phases him. He's just like, chill.
What does that do for you? You know, it's like, you know, no thanks. Tell me something about yourself some people would be surprised to hear or might find a little odd.
I'm vegan.
Oh, that's not odd. No? Come on, I'm interviewing musicians, dude. What are you kidding me?
I drive a 2006 Honda Odyssey.
Okay. good for you. 2006 Honda. How many miles you got on that sucker?
Oh, close to 100,000.
That's nothing for a Honda. You're just getting started, dude.
That's right. Well, I bought it used with low miles, man.
That's great.
It's funny, you know, so when I was playing in Vegas with The Who, and we were staying in LA and flying on a private jet to Vegas for the shows and flying back, right?
That must be awful.
Yeah, it's terrible. But it's funny because so we're in the private jet flying back, and the tour manager, who drives a really nice Porsche, was like, oh, John, I forgot to get you an Uber to go home. I was like, oh, dang. And then I was like, oh, yeah. I drove myself to the airport. My car's there. And then, so it came up, oh, what do you drive? And it's like, you know, The Who is in the private. It's like, these guys all have like, they're into cars. Like Pete and Roger, super into fancy cars and all this stuff.
Yeah.
So they're like, oh, wait, yeah. What kind of car do you have? I'm like, 2006 Honda Odyssey soccer fan. And they all just look perplexed. Like,
yeah, but what? If you're not into cars, it's like a car is like a pencil.
The worst investment you could ever make. I'm just like, you know, I bought it cash. Like, there you go.
Yeah, right.
And I love my Honda Odyssey. It's killer.
No, you, dude, look, you got a young family. You're doing all the, to me, you sound like a super smart dude. I mean, you know, like what are you going to do? Spend $100,000 on a car? Just because you have money doesn't mean you have to spend money on that. You know,
well, I got to save up for my retirement.
Yeah, man. For your kids' college education is what you got to save up for, man.
Yeah, right.
That's expensive. So don't all vegans drive 2006 Honda Odysseys?
No, they all drive 2004 Subarus.
Oh, Subaru, is that the thing out there? That's funny.
Or maybe a Volkswagen van.
A Subaru. I used to like. I like those Subarus. Are a Subaru around anymore? I don't think.
Oh, absolutely.
Oh, they are.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Do you have any non-musical superpowers? You must have some.
No, not that I can think of.
No, you gotta have some, man.
I thought about that question for a while. I can't non-musical super. I'd have to. You'd have to ask. Well, that sounds weird.
Was you have to say, ask your wife. All right, let's get her on the phone. No, I'm just kidding. There's a question I always feel I should be asking the wives, and I didn't ask it to you. I can't think of which one it was, but there's I don't know. Anyway.
What's an example of a non-musical superpower? I can't even think of
Like some guys, like they're really, you know, like a MacGyver type, you know, I could fix anything.
Right.
Or I'm really good at sports, you know, or I build, you know, widgets, you know, whatever, or I'm really good at painting. You know, I've had a lot of guys, you know, of course, a lot of creative guys.
I just play bass.
Yeah. I draw. Some guys draw really well.
Yeah. I can't do any of that.
No, but I think you're pretty I think you seem to be a pretty intuitive guy. That's a superpower, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I'm fairly clever. I think I can figure things out.
I think you are pretty clever, man. Yeah, for sure. And that's a superpower. I mean, John, there's a lot of stupid people out there. So that's a superpower, trust me. You have any hobbies outside of music?
I enjoy hiking.
Yeah, that's cool, man.
There are some really nice local mountains that I like to go to with some buddies. We go hike around. I was into motorcycles for a while, but I got nailed by a car, and then I had a kid. And
holy crap, man!
So
seriously, all right?
I got pretty hurt, but I'm good now.
Wow.
But so I gave that up. But that was a good hobby. I really enjoyed that. But it's a bit dangerous, especially for my career. I don't need to.
Yeah.
You don't need to bust up my hands.
Don't need to die on a motorcycle. Yeah,
well, even just, you know, I break a finger and I'm up a creek, you know?
Somebody told me, I was talking to some people here that were really into bikes, and it seems like it's a very, like, I have a couple of buddies who do it, and it seems really relaxing. And this is what they told me. They said, listen, if you take a motorcycle out on an old country road, it is gorgeous. There's nothing like it. Once you go on the highway, that goes from being a gorgeous thing to you're literally going to get killed.
Yeah. And I mean, the highway is just so, like, there's so much. It's loud and there's trucks and it's crazy. Yeah. I mean, my main thing, I love just going up, like you say, like there around here, around LA in the mountains, there are these little two lane mountain roads. You go on a weekday, there's nobody there.
Right. That seems
beautiful. Winding up these beautiful mountain roads. And it's just, And also one of the things that I loved about it was you have to focus on what you're doing. Completely, which is great because then you can't worry about all this other.
So it was a really good. It was like a good distraction. Yeah, it was like a meditation. That's great.
Yeah, because you're just focusing on that.
It's
really nice.
Is playing bass or playing your instrument somewhat of a meditation for you?
For sure.
Yeah, I would imagine.
Absolutely. Yeah, for sure. It's really actually interesting because, like a meditation, I'll find sometimes when I'm playing, like, memories and thoughts will just like pop into my head that I have not thought about ever for years, like just some random thing. Cause your mind is, hopefully your mind is so relaxed and open and like stuff just pops, like strange things just pop into your head. You're like, well, that was interesting. All right.
That's really cool. I got to tell you, I've only been playing guitar 3 years, and I got to tell you, that's the most, addictive part for me is when I play, I'm so present in what I'm doing and I feel so good. I wish I had time. I'd play for hours and hours a day without batting an eye. It's such a like cathartic, I'm always so much more zen afterwards.
Right.
Even if it's just a half hour or 40 minutes, I'm like so chilled out. It's just really, like, for me, really wonderful, you know, very.
It is. It's nice. I mean, it's funny, you know, when you get off stage from a big show like with The Who, it's definitely not. I mean, there's an aspect of that, but also you're just.
Oh, you're so, putting so much
emotionally
energy.
Like, oh, it's crazy. Yeah. To try sometimes to wind down after a show, it's pretty crazy because it's a lot of. It's a lot, you know, it's both exciting and draining and like you're putting so much emotion into it, but also like cerebral thought and focus and like,
it's. Well, plus you have the pressure of performing.
Yeah.
So it's not, you're playing, but you have you got a job to execute as well. And so it's not like, you know, a couple of guys hanging out in a bar, you know, just fooling around, you know, that whatever happens, happens.
It's a lot of pressure.
Yeah. And you're with guys that are at the top of their game and have done so for 50 years. So yeah, right. I could totally see that.
And every moment of my life is on YouTube. That's a weird thing. About like it used to be, you know, you screw up, it's gone. But now playing with a band like The Who,
Everything is on there. You know what? I've talked to a couple of guys, and one of the things that bother them the most is if they're not playing, or even if you're in a stadium or in a big arena like you're in, you're not, when you pick up your phone, you're not, the sound on this thing is not transferable, right?
Especially as a bass player.
Right. And so then what they said, what I really can't stand is somebody posts it and then somebody puts comments on there. God, this guy sounds awful. Can he get a good sound system? And he's like, I mean, really?
Thank you.
Really?
Thank you. Yes.
You know, or else.
Like I said, as a bass player,
worse.
Yeah. You know, and of course everybody's judging me because it's like, well, how does he compare to Entwistle,
right?
Kino Palladino,
right?
You know, and so they're just at home on YouTube, like looking up clips and like, oh, he's not loud enough. He doesn't have that sound. And it's like, dude, it's recorded on an iPhone. You're listening to it through laptop speakers, and like, come on.
I never engage. I have a couple of guys that they'll post stuff. Like one guy, I interviewed somebody, and he had an award that he won for a video that he made in the 80s. And so I said, oh, is there any chance it's on YouTube? He goes, maybe, I think so. And somebody apparently searched the entire internet, apparently. And I guess it wasn't there. And he goes, what a fucking idiot this guy. And this is what he's saying. He's taking the time to write. He's taking the time to actually write. Like he's got that. I mean, like, man, I wish I had that much time. I would never be spending it doing that, but I wish I had that much time to do nothing. And he's like, what a fucking idiot this is. How can you not know if your own video's on YouTube? Then other people are like, dude, most artists like aren't really obsessed with their own stuff. And like, you know, and then I don't answer those comments ever. And right. So he wrote another one like louder because I didn't answer it. No, it's just like nastier, like, hey, like, you know, it's like if you're talking to your child and, you know, you didn't hear him the first time, daddy, you know, let me say it again. But that's what it was like, okay. And I still am not, I mean, like who engages with stuff like that? But yeah, I mean, I feel for you, man, because everybody's a damn critic. Okay, get your ass out on there on stage with Daltrey and Townsend and see, you know, do a better job
with no sleep. Yeah, and I mean, you please. Know, people don't know what I mean. And you know, I don't need to make excuses for myself, but you know, like people don't know what you're going. You know, no, what's
and what this you're going isn't through. A culmination of a show, man. This is a culmination of, you know, 25, 35 years of you doing this.
Yeah,
you know, you didn't get there overnight. You got there over your lifetime. You know? So, sure. I mean, this is just stupid when people criticize like that. It irritates the shit. Because the people who do that have people who, like, it's probably in his mom's basement or something like that. And he's my age, you know? Anyway, rant over. What's your favorite? I just hate, you know, do something with your time, man. Feel good about yourself. Don't criticize, you know? Bitch. Favorite place you've traveled, man? You've probably been all over.
I have been all over. Yeah, I've been everywhere. It's actually really amazing to have gotten to see the world and gotten paid for it.
And played bass.
Yeah. I mean, Shakira, we went everywhere, which was incredible. Favorite place. I really loved Colombia.
Interesting.
And there are a few reasons I say that. One, I think, is partially because it's sort of different, you know, like, you know, if you say, I mean, a lot of people have been to Italy and Italy is amazing. And, you know, a lot of people have been to Hawaii. Hawaii is amazing, but everybody's been there. But I think Colombia is misunderstood from, especially from Americans.
Yeah.
You know, like, oh, Colombia.
Yeah.
That's scary.
The drug capital of. Yeah.
And the other reason that kind of helped me fall in love with it was that the first time I went there, the first show I did there was with an artist named Robbie Draco Rosa, who's really well known down there, not so well known up here. He wrote and produced Ricky Martin's big record.
Oh, wow.
He was also in Menudo. He's an amazing artist. So I was playing with him. We went to Columbia. First show we play there, some local people sort of started talking to me. Like, it was like off the side of the stage. It was a pretty big show, but they kind of worked their way up. They're like, hey, what's going on? You were great, blah, blah, blah. What are you doing tomorrow? I'm like, I don't know. They're like, we'll show you around. Here's my number. Call me. So this is like day two in Colombia, and they're like the sweetest people in the world. They call me up. Take me out, show me around, blah, blah, blah. And then, so I hung with them on that trip. And then the next time I came, like, I mean, on that trip, I think I had a day off and they took me out to their like parents' country house, which was amazing outside of Bogota.
And they did not kidnap you. No.
Right.
Right.
They didn't.
Cause that's the other thing you hear about down in South America, all the, you know, that kind of stuff.
For sure. Yeah. And that's part of why I was able to enjoy it, because the next time I came, I was touring again with Robbie Rosso. We came there again, I think. And I said, hey, I want to stay an extra 3 days after
that's cool,
our
man.
Tour is done. So I hung out with these people and like, we went off to some other like place out in the country, and you couldn't, you know, if you're just some tourist,
no, you're not privy to it. Yeah.
You have to know where not to go.
Yeah.
There. And if you know where to go, it's fine. You're safe.
That's great.
So I was with some locals that took me under their wing, and they were sweet as can be and just showed me an amazing time and showed me the real Colombia.
I bet the food is delicious there.
Yeah, it was amazing. I mean, and just it's beautiful there. Just beautiful. And the people are incredible. And just, you know, seeing all kinds of amazing stuff and – that was really a rich experience.
That's cool, man.
So
you get to, they have a lot of supposedly good coffee there too. Is that I'm like a bit of a coffee snob. Is a good too. Yeah.
Yeah.
I love good. That's cool, man. Very. That's a new one. I've not heard that.
Yeah.
Toughest to see. No, talk about a specific experience that changed your life or altered the way you think about things.
Oof, man, I don't know. I mean, I suppose deciding to go for it and move to LA, right?
Yeah.
I mean, or even deciding to, you know, move from a lat, like.
Yeah, that's a big move. I think that's a huge move.
Yeah, I was 18, got in my car by myself, you know, got my bass and a couple.
Wait a minute. You drove?
Yeah.
Through Canada and.
Yeah.
Wow.
3,020 something miles.
Wow.
It took me 7 days.
Yeah.
I'm 18 by myself.
Did you sleep in your car or did you sleep in hotels?
I had
or?
A tent.
A tent?
Wow. Part of the way.
You are like a rustic mountain guy. That's awesome.
Yeah. And I, man, I had a crazy, so.
That is wild. I wish I.
It was pretty wild.
Yeah. I wish I would mean, be comfortable.
I can't believe my parents just were like, yeah, see you later. Good luck.
Well, what are they going to do? As a parent, once, and especially you were like the fifth kid.
Yeah.
Oh, once you're 18, it's like, you know, you don't even think to do anything because you know they're not going to listen and they have the right to do what they want.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, we and it got easier and easier with each kid because you learn that lesson, you know, and it's just easier for them, easier for you. And they can't say anything.
Right. But I.
That's wild, man.
It was scary at times. Yeah. So when you're going through like Eastern Alaska and through Canada, it gets pretty like it's a little 2-lane road and there's nothing.
Ice truckers.
Yeah, right. Well, thankfully it was in the summer. But yeah, pretty much. So you know, I had a, you know, Toyota Corolla and I'm driving along and, you know, you start to hear like some funny, like, is my car going to break down? And like, because you're not seeing,
of course.
You know, there aren't other cars passing. You're just like, it's you. And
that's amazing.
Like, I mean, yeah. And there was one point where I was running low on gas. And I was like, okay, I'll stop at the next gas station. I stopped at the next gas station and they were either their power
400
was out,
miles away.
Right. Kind of. They were either they were out of gas, the gas station ran out of gas, or they didn't have electricity, one or the other. And so there was a decision of like, I can go back like 20 miles or go forward 40 miles. And I was on, and so I think, I forget the exact deal, but like I had to go to another gas station and one gas station was out of electricity. The other one that I went to that was like 20 miles away was out of gas. And then, I mean, and I'm in the middle of nowhere and I remember that being like,
yeah, that's a stressful. That's a big move for a young kid.
Yeah. And I managed to like, somehow it worked out clearly. And, you know, yeah, found a spot and worked it out.
You do these things that challenge you and that's what gives you the confidence for the next thing, you know?
True. It
gives you the coping skills and
builds character.
It does, man. I mean, you know, it does. You don't build character sitting in the bed, man, watching TV, you know? I mean, that's just the reality of it. You build character, but by being scared of doing shit and doing it anyway, and sometimes failing at it and sometimes not, you know?
Right. And that's then really cool, man. You build character further by rolling into Texas in August. And it's 350 degrees and like humid, and I'm like, I've never experienced heat like this. My car, like,
oh, and there's no humidity. There's no humidity.
Yeah, it's pretty mellow. I mean, yeah, it's not. That's right. It's fairly arid where I grew up in Alaska, and it doesn't get that hot.
Yeah,
and you know, you don't. A lot of cars at that point in Alaska, you don't have air conditioning. Like, why?
Oh my god. Oh yeah, because you don't need it. It's like being in England; they don't have air conditioners in their house.
Yeah. So I have a car with no air conditioning, and the dorm this. Piece of junk dorm that you stay in your first year there.
Yeah.
No air conditioning. So.
Oh, you're kidding.
I'm like.
Wait a minute.
Talk about shock. And
that's really oppressive that they don't have AC in the dorm.
No, they probably do now, but back in the dark ages when I was there.
Yeah. That's
but talk weird. About building character.
Yeah. That's.
Ooh, man.
God, I think they even have air conditioning in prisons. They couldn't have it in a dorm. I would think, you know? Wow. Good for you, man.
Yeah.
Anything you regret not doing?
Well, we talked, I think.
Background vocals?
My singing.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that was, I can't think of like a gig that came. Oh, no, that's right. So what I was playing with a couple of friends back in the day, Clito Escobedo and Jeff Babko, a couple of LA guys.
Yeah,
Jeff
Babko, why do I know that name?
Jeff Babko is a very well-known keyboard player.
He's
a monster. Big LA session guy and does everything, plays with everyone. Great guy. So they had a band, like an original band. Mm. This is way back. And I was playing with them. We recorded a few things, maybe played a couple gigs, blah, blah. And then I think I got called to do the Michelle Branch tour, maybe. Some tour came up. And I'm like, sorry, dudes, I'm going to bail. I'm going to go do this tour. And that their band, sort of the nucleus of that band, ended up becoming the house band for what's the late night TV show host?
Jimmy Kimmel.
Jimmy Kimmel. Thank you. So I don't know that I would have ended up on that.
Yeah.
But maybe if I had hung with that, maybe I would have had like 15 years of steady in town
work. Was Toshi in that band then?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
I interviewed him. He's a good guy.
He's great.
Great player too.
He's amazing and hilarious and all that.
Really, he's funny.
But so that's one, you know, somewhere in the back of my mind, I always go, huh, I wonder.
Yeah, that's a tough one.
You know, because, I mean, that was one dream of mine as a kid. Like, my oldest brother turned me on to David Letterman.
Mm-hmm.
And I used to watch David Letterman to watch the band.
Right.
Because, you know, Will Lee and all those guys. It was Steve Jordan back in the day. And that was sort of a dream of mine, like to be the house band on one of those TV shows. I mean, that's a seemingly pretty cool gig. I know. I think it can get kind of tedious.
I think if I did a survey, would you rather be in the house band on Kimmel or in The Who?
Yeah, right.
I think you'd win with The Who. I could be wrong.
Yeah.
But that's my knee-jerk reaction. I will stick with that.
Things have worked out all right.
But I understand what you're saying. You always kind of wonder.
Yeah. And I mean, the aspect of the house band on a TV show when you have a wife and a son is like you can stay home.
Yeah. Except, you know? Like Jimmy V, I interviewed him, and they don't have a band anymore. Conan, they got rid of all the music on the show.
Right.
So, you know, then there's always that aspect.
Sure.
You never know. So
Nothing lasts forever. So, I mean, you know, no big regrets. Things have worked out quite nicely. I cannot complain.
I'm
very blessed.
I think you're in your right place too, because you seem like everything is very organic with you. You know how things have come about. So I think you're kind of in where you're supposed to be there too. You know?
Yeah, I think so. It feels fairly natural.
Last question, man. And I really appreciate your time. You've been wonderful to talk to, man. I mean, you're a super cool guy. Thank you for being so open and so easy to talk with.
Yeah. Back at you.
Thanks, man. Biggest change in your personality over the last 10 years, and how much of that has been intentional and how much is just a natural part of aging?
Oh, I would say a lot of it is a natural part of aging. I don't know that I've changed a lot. I think I would probably, hopefully, like we talked about, I worry less.
You're pretty aware, so I bet you have changed more than you think.
Maybe.
No, you got a pretty high level of
awareness. Changing, you know, like you're stuck with yourself every day. So, you know, you leave for a month, you come back and you see your kids change, right? But when you're with them every day, you don't notice those changes.
I
would say
Adam Zimmern.
Who?
Adam Zimmern.
Very well. He's a dear friend.
I figured you did. I asked him this question one time.
Adam's hilarious.
He's so funny.
So funny. So dry and brilliant.
He's coming down here soon too. I'm looking forward to hooking up with him. And I'm laughing because he was just funny. I said to him something like, you know, what do you like about yourself? And he goes, how can I answer that question when I have so much self-loathing?
Oh,
you reminded me of that when you said, "Oh, I can't see myself change," or something like that. Reminded me of Adam.
Yeah, I mean, I think worrying less, sticking up for myself more, like we talked about, not being too nice, being nice to myself.
Good for you, man.
And you know, like you know, and being more confident and brave. I think you know, as you get older, you get a little more confident and also just by nature of, I mean, you know, once you jump up on stage with The Who and play in front of a stadium, you know.
Yeah, man, you're up on stage with The Who. Screw you, bitches. That's right, man. John Button, bass player with The Who.
Oh, man.
That's awesome.
Yeah, you gotta, some man, you, you have to keep that in check, man. It's easy every once in a while. It's, you know, some thing ain't going right at the grocery store. Do you know who I am? I play with Every once in a while, that thought will creep up in the back of your head. You're just like, no, no.
Kids are the humbling factor, man, I think, probably, right?
Oh.
Because your kid doesn't care who you are and what you do for a living, man. He's going to be your, you know, your kid and, you know, you're just,
I mean, he kind of knows and he, you know, he thinks it's kind of cool, but.
He's only five, you said, right?
Yeah.
And he knows already. That's pretty good.
Yeah. He's a clever little dude.
Good, man. Send his ass away to college sooner, you know?
Right? Maybe.
Man, I can't thank you enough for everything, John. I really appreciate it. Anytime, come back here anytime you want. Anything you want to, you're doing any project, please come back. I'd love to support it, man. I really appreciate it. You've been great to talk to, and hopefully I'll see you down here soon.
Yeah, I'll let you
know. Yeah, please do. Everybody, thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this interview, please share it with a friend or on your social media channels. We appreciate your support. Thanks very much to John Button for spending time with us. Check out John on tour with The Who, with Roger Daltrey. Any other projects you got working on?
Nope.
All right. Well, check him out on tour with The Who and Roger Daltrey. And make sure you go to everyonelovesguitar.com. Sign up to get on our newsletter list so you and I can connect. And most important, remember that happiness is a choice, so choose wisely. Be nice, go play your guitar or your bass, and have fun.
Yeah, man.
Till next time, peace and love, everybody. I'm out. We hope you enjoyed this show. If you did, subscribe to the Everyone Loves Guitar podcast, and you can do this online at everyonelovesguitar.com or on iTunes. And if you like the show, please leave us a 5-star positive review. The more 5-star reviews we get, the higher our show ranks, and higher rankings mean we get to continue speaking with cool, interesting guests on our show. We'll see you on the next episode, and until then, keep playing your guitar and have fun making music.